in the hallway. We would have no access. We'd be in no studio. And it would be even worse than the situation we're currently in. So wonderful work by whatever student intern here at the Marist College Center for Sports Communication decided that we need the swipe card access to get to the other studio. A terrible job to everyone else for failing miserably this morning. I think that about covers it.
Although we may have the same amount of listeners if we were talking in the hallway as we do now.
Fair. That's a fair point. That's a very angry point.
That's
and a fair
defeatist point. It's a defeatist point. It's a defeatist point. So I'm doing all the cleanup right now. So not only, by the way, did you do nothing upstairs. By the way, we are one of those organizations, when things get bad, we fracture. We're not one of those groups.
So I was doing my job. Oh, I was waiting by the microphone as you abandoned your post. You abandoned your post.
That was very important.
I was waiting by the microphone
What I did
for when Anna said, okay, we're on. And then I was going to start talking. Because you know what would have been really bad if we're on and nobody's near a microphone to talk?
Would have sounded a lot like what it sounded like, which was dead air. So but I will say, when things get rough, we would be the worst military operation ever. Because as soon as anything got bad, we would shoot each other. We would sell it.
We just start yelling at each other.
We would be horrible, horrible. This would be like the worst version of the A-Team ever. So we would be awful.
Pretty bad.
So, but you did nothing. All you were willing to do was get up and move. That's all you were willing to do.
Well, that was all we could do at that point.
That's all you were willing to do.
We didn't want to say die.
That's
you were
right.
Just
yeah.
giving up.
Don't just give up.
No, I wasn't giving up. I was going
up.
To plan B.
You are so haughty
that you believe that plan A, because it's your plan and is so perfectly and benevolently designed, is always going to work without flaw. And that plan A should never, ever be abandoned, because you would rather wait 45 minutes to finally get your way of doing things to work than just realizing, oh, hey, wait a minute, there's an easier way. Let's go down to the situation that we know works, that we can set up in 2 seconds, and just start using that when we run into problems with plan A. That's what happened. So I'm sitting there. I'm like, all right, maybe they'll fix it soon. Maybe they will. But they won't. I knew that. And then I was like, maybe we should try plan B. And then we did, and look where we are.
Right now, not only am I doing basically carrying the show, and not only did I get us on the air, but I also am now dealing with getting our guests on because we had a problem.
Now Anna's playing a recording of the show that we just did.
We're on.
Oh, good. All right, we're on.
It means we're on.
Hi, everybody.
Oh, are we on online?
Hi, everybody.
Yeah.
Could you post that on the center? Can you post that on our Twitter feed? Be like, look, you can't watch us because, I don't know, Mike Wallace screwed. Somehow it's Mike Wallace. But can you get that live feed on the ESPN, on the classrooms?
Yeah. I'm going right now.
All right. I say we do a sports show now. What do you think?
That's great.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's do it.
You know what we should do, though? We need to take a break.
Well, yes, I'm going to give the quick topic rundown, then we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to do a sports show. Here's what we're going to talk about this morning. Steve Kerr, who suffered a tremendous back injury last year, he's the coach of the Golden State Warriors. He tried marijuana to help him recover, and then he made some comments this week saying that he doesn't understand why his players and professional athletes can't use marijuana to recover from their injuries and to help ease their pain. We're going to talk about whether marijuana has a use in professional sports leagues and whether it should be legal. We're going to talk about some new Olympic sports, some sports that might be coming to the next Olympiad. Cheerleading is on the list, believe it or not, and we'll talk about that. As we've learned with the college football playoff, clearly if you win your conference championship, that doesn't matter. We'll talk about whether that's good or bad. We'll have some grades of the week. We'll maybe debate an esoteric sports topic in necessary detail and probably descend even further into madness. So why not just hang out? Because class is in session. We're back after this on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio.
Can I see those?
We're back in the classroom, everybody. Chaos this morning. We thank you for bearing with us through some technical difficulties. Jeff Brault, Dr. Keith Schroeder, Anna Grizulis, Michael Hines. No live stream this week.
I don't know where all my stuff is, by the way, right
now. It's probably upstairs
in the
first
studio. You know what? This is and I actually saw something on this on television, on a news show. They tell you in a plane emergency, just leave all your stuff.
Yeah, they say that in every emergency. Fires, otherwise.
Well, I don't like it.
No, I know you don't.
We had an emergency, and I left some stuff upstairs, and I want it.
Well, there's nothing you value more than things.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so I left some things upstairs, and it bothers me.
Let's do a sports show. Let's regroup.
Anna, did you tweet out our link
so
people can stream it?
All right,
we're ready to roll. We're ready for your weekly Smart Look at Sports. And by the way, on Facebook, ESPN The Classroom, on Twitter, at ESPN _ Classroom, archives of the portion of this program that actually made it on air, available via iTunes. Just search for ESPN The Classroom in the podcast section. Okay. Let's just, you know what? No funny rambling intro. Anna, let's just get right to the big story. Anna was hoping for a funny rambling intro.
It's pretty loud. I feel like we're blowing people's eardrums off.
Mm, we're fine.
It's just your headphone volume. Last year, Golden State Warriors head coach Steve Kerr was crippled by back pain. It was so severe that he missed half of his team's record-breaking regular season. Steve Kerr, as many people who deal with debilitating injuries are, was desperate for relief, so much so that he tried pot. He tried marijuana.
Yes, wacky weed.
Kerr then this week laid out that he believes that the NBA and other sports league policies on the use of marijuana are silly and potentially harmful to players. Said Kerr this week, quote, "I tried it a few times. It did not agree with me at all. So I'm not the expert on this stuff, but I do know this." This is a quote from Steve Kerr. "If you're an NFL player in particular and you've got a lot of pain, I don't think there's any question that pot is better for your body than Vicodin." Some of Steve Kerr's players, including Draymond Green and Klay Thompson, came out and, quote, applauded their coach for being brave enough to speak out on this issue. And a lot of people think that someone like Steve Kerr coming out and saying that he believes that professional athletes should be able to use marijuana to deal with pain could help advance that conversation. So, Keistra, let me know where Steve Kerr stands. Where do you stand?
You did this on
the use of marijuana in sports.
I'm probably slightly different than some of the rest of the people in this room, younger people.
Better-looking people?
No, that does not exist.
Definitely different.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome, Michael.
Please.
Us beautiful people have to stick together.
Trust me. There's no one better-looking in this room than I am. Let's just get that off the table right now.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I mean, if we're going to do this.
Anna, who did say before we got on the air.
I'm not saying I am, but who says that? Ever.
Have you met Keith Rudler and his ego? Anna did say, the last thing Anna said before we got on air following all the technical difficulties, she was upset that we weren't on our video live stream because, quote, "I look good today."
Okay. All right. Well, I look good every day. So this is, so here's the thing. All right. Here's the thing. I am okay with athletes using marijuana for medicinal purposes to deal with pain. Right. And I agree with many that it's probably safer than, Vicodin, oxycodone, and all the things that you see athletes getting hooked on. I think we over-medicalize, that's not the right word.
Over-medicate?
Over-medicate. I'm sorry, that was bad. Over-medicate far too much, and we should probably figure out other ways to deal with pain or make it so we don't play hurt. You know, we don't try to play through different kinds of pain. And the NBA season is grueling, and I get it. And the NFL is even worse. Here's what I don't agree with, though. This idea that we have somehow started to normalize the use of marijuana. And I say this kind of seriously. The fact that pot has no repercussion or that it's in no way dangerous or, hey, it's no big deal, I think that's a message that can be in some ways harmful. I'm probably a little bit more puritanical than some of the rest of the people in this room. I think we, as a society, we've normalized drinking too much. I think we've normalized recreational drug use too much. And to the extent that marijuana use by professional athletes is seen as simply condoning this as, hey, you could do it all the time, it's no big deal. I think there are ramifications of that kind of activity. And so I'm not one that believes strongly and we need to start making law after law after law, but I do think that this becomes a normalization. Look, the drinking laws are more lax in Europe than they are in America, yet they don't drink to excess like we do in America. So I'm not pretending, and I know I believe over the phone we referred to myself as a communist last night, but which I don't think is.
You refer to yourself as a communist.
That's true. That's
you
fair.
Said at one point, "I guess I'm a communist." So, like, it just hit you.
So I get that, but on the other hand, I also will suggest that that we do need to make sure that message isn't corrupted by the wrong message.
We've got a guest in the classroom this morning with a number of different perspectives on this issue. Let's welcome to the program for the first time Mr. Josh Greer. He's a doctoral student, a lecturer at UT Martin, a fitness instructor, and he coaches some football as well. So he's seen athletes from all sides, and he's studied sport from an academic
perspective.
And he's
an expert on use of drug use by athletes. So.
Josh, welcome to the classroom. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you all. First of all, I want to say that opening remark, that was excellent. I was going to talk a little bit about social norms. They have shifted towards the positive light for marijuana because currently we have 29 states that have medical marijuana laws, or you look at legal recreational use, medical or decriminalized. So there's 29 states that are currently on our map that have, you know, marijuana laws. So it's, whenever you look at it that way, you have a lot of people and a lot of different businesses, organizations. You look at the NFL, you look at the NBA, they're like, hey, I play for the Denver Broncos. I should be able to use marijuana. But local policy and organizational policies differ. Why are they different? Well, there's still an issue with marijuana, as you stated. Since 1970, it's been a Scheduled One drug. What does that mean? According to the DEA, that means that there's no medical use, and it's the highest level of addiction. Now, while I do not agree with that definition, because, you know, there are finding medical use for marijuana. If you have chronic pain, there's medical use. CBD is part of marijuana. You could take out THC, which is a psychoactive ingredient that actually gives you that high. You can use that for medicine. I see that used for medicine. And there's still, you know, 7 to 9% of people are addicted to marijuana. A lot of people say, there's no way you're not addicted to marijuana, but there is. 7 to 9% of people, and the earlier you start, the more likely you are to get addicted. It could go all the way up to 21% if you start around the age of 12 or 13, pre-adolescent.
Our guest, Josh, so, with a good primer, yes, there on marijuana use, and I think that's important. I actually spent a lot of time last night educating myself on those very types of issues as well. Because, you know, you think about it, and everybody just assumes they kind of know what marijuana is and know what the effects are. And you hear other people, and they're like, oh, it's a gateway drug. And you hear other people like, no one's ever died from marijuana. And actually, when you try to find some sort of research, some sort of academia behind it, you know, it changes your perspective a little bit. Josh, where do you come down on Steve Kerr's comments in saying that he believes that professional sports leagues in America's laws banning marijuana are silly? Do you believe that professional athletes should be able to use it for medicinal purposes?
In my honest opinion, if you take out THC, the psychoactive ingredient, then 100% yes. I do think that you can use marijuana without getting high. I also do not agree with the standpoint of smoking anything because you're still releasing carcinogens into your body. I state that in my classroom. I state that everywhere. Anytime you smoke anything, especially an unfiltered cigarette with marijuana, then what are you going to do? You're putting chemicals into your body. Now, there are edibles now. There's oil now. There's different things that you could potentially use for pain. And they're, right now, the NFL is currently doing studies. Eugene Monroe, he was a left tackle in the NFL, 7th overall pick. The Ravens, he's actually leading the charge. I've communicated several times with Jake Plummer, retired NFL athlete. Now, he's an advocate for recreational use and medical use. But marijuana, the plant, yeah, I do think you can use it. Just the THC level is what's differentiating people's opinions on whether it should be for recreational use, whether it should be for medical use, or whether it should be for both. If you go back to the 1970s, THC levels, around 10 to 15%. Right now, they're around 25 to 35%, and they can go much higher. If you look at wax, it's a concentrated form of THC. It's up to 90%. So do I think that should be legalized? No, probably not. But I do think that there is a happy medium between using marijuana and then opioid abuse. So,
you know, part of the issue, I think, around the use of marijuana by athletes isn't that they're using it, but rather that the younger athletes, high school athletes, junior high school athletes, that they look at this and they see this as a normalization of that process. What do you think the impact of professional athletes or leagues allowing their athletes to use medical marijuana might have on high school athletes? Is there a way to kind of condone it for the adults and tell the kids? This is the same issue we have with steroids. Is there a way to condone certain types of behaviors by the pros and yet still keep it out of the high school game?
No, there's not. I mean, we're seeing that shift now in states such as Colorado. There's a study that was released 2 years ago, and I wish I had the author's names, but they're already seeing a shift. In Colorado, if you live there right now, you could go buy marijuana as long as you were 21 years of age. And they do a great job IDing you, but guess what? If you're 21 years of age in New York or in Tennessee, you can go buy alcohol, correct?
Correct.
How many kids get alcohol? Several.
Let's do a roll call on this.
Some studies say that 50% of all alcohol consumed in the United States are those 20 years and younger. 50%. Where are they getting it? From those who are 21 years and older.
But is it, I mean...
They're going to use it.
There's sort of a stigma regarding marijuana. You know, you mentioned taking the THC and the hallucinatory elements out of it, and obviously that's correct. It's what makes it medicinal and not recreational. But if you remove the stigma from marijuana and a doctor prescribes it, say, to a 13-year-old, and it's safe and it's effective, I mean, how is that much different than, say, giving a 13-year-old Advil? I just feel like there's a cultural stigma surrounding marijuana right now that would lead people to believe, you know, if I'm a high school football player and you're like, well, I'm going to prescribe him marijuana to deal with his knee pain, everybody would go, I'm sorry? like doctors would be run out of town on a rail. Yeah. But I think a lot of that has to do less with the effect of the drug and more with the societal stigma surrounding it, no?
Yeah, you're correct. But if they say that they prescribed him CBD, which is cannabinoid, then it would be different. So, yeah, there is a bad stigma, and it starts with Richard Nixon, to be honest. If you go back and look, he wanted a war on marijuana. So since then, you could go back to the 30s and stuff where they had actual marijuana tax cards where you could actually have it. It was legal, but you had to have it taxed, and it was a difficult time. But then they had Reefer Madness, and you go through. There is a bad stigma because we either see two types of people whenever we talk about marijuana use. We see, like, Willie Nelson or we see Little Wayne, and that's what we expect. We expect for them to be either a burnout or someone who
long hair hippie type
uses it all the time. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yet both of them very successful at what they do.
That's right.
They do, yeah.
Pick the right career path, both I think. isn't the real issue here, the real issue that it isn't just the marijuana, it's that we are asking our athletes to play through way too much pain. I mean, I think part of the reason we're looking towards marijuana is we're starting to realize that these other normally prescribed drugs are pretty darn dangerous. And I think Brett Favre brought a lot of that to light.
Yeah.
When you realize, like, if you're going to play in the NFL, you're going to get hooked on painkillers at some point.
OxyContin is one time-release coating away from just being heroin.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. No, I mean, that's not too far away from the truth. Which heroin was prescribed in our states a long time ago. But to get back on point, Calvin Johnson stated that he retired because of this reason, right? One of the greatest receivers of all time. Because he was afraid of getting addicted to opioid use. If you look at Dr. Linda Kotler's study on retired NFL athletes in 2011, she shows this issue. She surveyed 650-plus retired NFL athletes, and some of them still have an addiction issue with opioids, even though they might not still have that chronic pain. And so there is an issue. I don't know in the Northeast, but Tennessee's the second most prescribed state for opioids, and we see the issues all the time, athlete or non-athlete alike.
What happens
when people can't afford those opioids, they actually go to heroin. Oh. And heroin use is actually, you can see that with retired NFL athletes as well. There was a percentage, and I don't want to misquote it, but there was a percentage saying that they actually use heroin because they cannot afford opioids. Remember, not all athletes retired millionaires.
Now.
And so whenever you're addicted to a drug, what's going to happen?
So, interesting question for you. Is this a sports problem or is this a society problem? Is the fact that we're dealing with the sports world that when you have pain, you get prescribed this because they want you back on the field. But this is a larger issue, right? Now, how do you address this larger issue?
Yeah, I mean, one step at a time. It starts with education. A lot of people don't realize we have an opioid problem because we trust our doctors, correct? We all do. Well, they prescribed it, so it must be correct. While I'm not saying do not trust your doctors, for a long time in America, we didn't question anything. We just went ahead and we took whatever was prescribed to us. Oh, I got a tooth pulled and they gave me 30 Vicodin. Well, in 2 days, it might not feel bad, but they gave me 30 Vicodin. So what am I going to do? If I don't use it, I keep it in my house. But if I keep it in my house and I don't have it locked up, what's going to happen? Someone could break in. One of your kids could take it. A friend could take it. And so that's what you see all the time.
Last question. 10 years from now, where do you think the status of marijuana, medical marijuana, will be in the professional sports leagues? Do you think that'll be normalized, accepted by the NFL, or do you think that they will kind of still play the, we'll turn our eyes and kind of look away?
I think it'll be normalized only if our states continue down the path that they're going right now. Federally, it's still illegal. federally, even though we have all these states that have either legalized, have it for medical use, or have decriminalized this drug, it's still federally illegal. So therefore, I think we'd have to get over that hurdle, and you'd have to see more states pass laws to support either medical marijuana use or recreational use before it happened. But in 10 years, it could. I mean, I really do. I think we're getting out of this bubble of saying marijuana is bad. Now, do I agree with it? I don't think any time you smoke anything, it's good for you. I don't care if it's cigarettes. I don't care if it's marijuana. I don't care if it's Bible paper, to be honest. Anytime you put any smoke into your lungs, it is bad for you. With that being said, the social norms are changing.
Josh Greer, a lecturer at UT Martin, a doctoral student, football coach, and a guy who spent a lot of time studying drug use, marijuana use in sports, just made his first appearance in the classroom. Thanks for coming on. We appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you so much. Have a good day.
That was good. That was a good discussion.
That was really very good. He clearly knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff.
That's,
and you know
that's
what
we like to have on here in this program.
And let me say this. I think you might have expected that you might be getting there might be some moralizing.
So what I expected, I ask you, I go, where's our guest? Where do you think our guest is going to come down on this issue? Because we try to prepare for this program and prepare for the viewpoints of our guest. And
although we can't, the technical issues obviously.
We thought that our guest would have a different perspective and that he would be against the use of marijuana in sports, which is, I believe, something Keith Strother supports. Well, but I do not.
I tend to think that a lot of people that work in athletic administration tend to come down on that side because I think it's a hard thing to manage, and I think they see some of the stuff that we don't, and they see some of the negative side effects. And I think this is also why I think a lot of people that work in college sports often people I respect a lot often don't believe in pay for play because they see it from a different perspective than we
True.
Do. We see it from the outside, we're like just pay them, right? And we look at it kind of this a very kind of. Pollyannish kind of way of looking at it versus someone who's actually working in the nitty gritty. And I thought Josh might share more of that perspective, but he had a very interesting, nuanced way of looking at it. I thought that was really good. But I think he hit to me the nail on the head that, all right, so we start prescribing drugs, and a lot of this is tied, like you inferred, it's this kind of cultural stigma that Richard Nixon kind of laid out for us.
Drugs equal bad is sort of the baseline we've been operating from.
Yeah, Reefer Madness, exactly. But I appreciated that Josh reminded us that drugs aren't okay. Just because we use them for certain things doesn't mean they're safe. And it's always okay. And I'm not even talking – look, I know you're like a live and let live libertarian.
I'm very, very liberal on drug – here's what I will say about drugs. Drugs are a tool. Advil to heroin, drugs are a tool. They are used for a purpose.
Right.
If you abuse that purpose, they are bad. They're not inherently
bad. Well, I don't think heroin has a purpose other than to get you strung out and sleeping on a street corner.
It's a pain reliever.
Sure.
So again, I mean, there is a purpose.
I can use a bomb to clean my house.
Yes. Again, it's the use of the tool. It's the use of the tool that can be bad.
I mean, at one point, Advil wasn't a thing.
Like, well, because they hadn't created it yet.
Exactly. Right. So all drugs start somewhere.
Also, the earth wasn't a thing.
I think going back to the college sports thing, I think there's something to be said for
Dinosaurs.
The fact that the other day, wow, 2 years ago, NCAA actually lessened the punishment for if you were drug tested and they found marijuana a positive test for THC, you used to get an entire season suspension, and now it's only half a season. And a lot of colleges actually don't even test for marijuana anymore.
They don't want to know.
That's basically what the NBA said. Somebody asked Adam Silver, they're like, what do you think about Steve Kerr's comments? And Adam Silver was basically like, well, right now it's included on a banned substances list. That's collectively bargained. And he's like, and if maybe in the future it wasn't, then that's fine.
In fact, I think the new NCAA policy now is if you get caught smoking marijuana, you have to go to confession. I'm not entirely sure. By the way, the Adam Silver story has got me now. You know what we're going to be talking about in the next segment.
We'll talk about that in our next segment.
We're going to talk about
Adam Silver's predecessor.
We're going to talk about how smart I am.
Adam Silver's predecessor,
yes,
David Stern,
yeah,
met with Keith Strother and the Marist College Center for Sports Communication this week. And it led to some surprising results.
Well, the only thing that's not surprising, which we'll get to after the break, is how good I am at my job. That's the only thing that's not surprising.
Keith Strudler failed upward this week. And we'll talk about that next in the classroom. Fox 1220, 97.3, ESPN Radio. More of your weekly Smart Look at Sports here in Poughkeepsie. I'm Jeff Brault alongside Anna Grizulis and Michael Hines. A couple interns for the Marist College Center. No.
No, why
Turn
not?
Turn up your headphones. Turn
no,
them up
there's
on
nothing
your
on
dial.
The there's nothing on the headphones unless you hit the Q button.
Turn them off.
Turn on the Q button. No, you're
I understand the Q button and how the Q button
works.
That's
the only way we're going to hear ourselves.
The Q button leads to problems.
No, it doesn't.
It leads to problems.
No, it doesn't.
There are issues now that you've created. You've created problems for all of us.
Hello.
What problem have I created for you?
Well, not for me. You've created problems for all of us. Now, that said, that's
what
Dr. Keith Strudler runs the Marist College.
You think we're feeding back? You think we're feeding in a loop?
Yes. No, I don't think we're feeding in a loop. I think when this button's on,
yeah,
it's always on.
What
always.
Does that mean?
It's always on. It's on
we
when there's commercials
it
playing. It's on when everything.
We turn the whole thing off then.
He's trying
we
to be
usually,
preventative.
Almost always, this button's never on at
but
all.
But Strudler is a narcissist, as we already know.
That
so
has
he needs to hear himself, which
we
is
actually,
why.
We, there you go.
There we go.
Don't turn that off. See, now it's gone. Now it's gone. Now it's on.
Okay, now
it's gone.
You are screaming. You're going to break their ears.
I'm not going to break anything if Jeff just stops acting like a small child.
Okay, that's a little better.
Turn it on. All right, can we talk about what
so
I did
this week?
this week,
Keith Strudler took a number of students from the Marist College Center for Sports
30.
To New York City for a conversation with former NBA Commissioner David Stern.
Mm-hmm. As per our partnership with the Sports PR Summit, Brian Berger, who runs the Sports Business Radio podcast, did a one-on-one conversation with the former commissioner of the NBA, David Stern. And we were very, very lucky to be the academic group that was going to be the studio audience for that at the Players Tribune, a lovely venue. We've been there before. And the first 45, 50 minutes of the event was Brian doing a one-on-one with the former commissioner. And the additional 30, 40 minutes were students asking questions. It was mainly Marist students. There was a few Columbia Business graduate students in there as well. And our students asked questions and – as I expected, our students asked the most insightful questions and actually broke national news.
They did break national news. A student asked about the Chris Paul trade, right. The cancellation of the Chris Paul trade.
Yes.
Where he eventually ended up in the Clippers, but he was supposed to go to the Lakers. And then David Stern at the time,
allegedly,
the Charlotte team was under NBA control.
Yes.
And David Stern was like, no. We don't approve this. This isn't happening. That made national news because I guess he had never made the comments that he made
to
the Marist student publicly before.
Yeah, he basically, as he said during the conversation, he really went radio silent and
he took a lot of heat
for potentially that decision. It was kind of deemed tampering and getting in the way of kind of the free market, and he really didn't talk about it. In fact, had a couple of arguments with some journalists in the interim since then. Jim Rome, I think, famously had a pretty big argument with him on that. And one of our students asked a question about that. And Stern, really for the first time, went on record and answered the question. And that, of course, became a national news story.
And there was also a question asked about when the NBA changed the ball.
Sure, another kind of
another thing that made, news.
Yes.
And that was asked by a Marist student.
And also made a little bit of national news. It also included one of the articles.
Two very good questions that generated very good answers.
Keith
Strudler,
exactly.
I'm curious from your perspective,
yeah.
when your students, you know, yeah. your proud young minds that you are molding,
right.
when they ask these questions of an important and let's be honest, intimidating figure in David Stern, when they stood up and asked these questions and showed that courage, what did you think about the questions at the time they were asked?
I thought, you know, this is really reflective of the kind of insightful, theory-based education that we provide them here to really bring truth to power, to really...
Okay.
No. Don't pull out that phone.
I'm just going
to
say...
Do not read that.
That
do not
I
read.
I was sitting
don't
next
read
to
that,
Dr. Strudler during these questions,
right.
And his immediate response was to tap me and say, we should have screened these. We should have screened these.
That's not true.
Funny you should say that,
no,
Keith Strudler.
Hold on. Because he changed his mind.
Putting your hand in my face on the radio doesn't work.
So he was a little worried at first, and then we made national news, and he realized that, you know what? Those questions were good questions.
That's a kind of a don't read that on the air.
So, Jeff, what do you have to say about it?
Don't read that on the air.
I'm just going to say.
No, no, no.
I'm just going to say that someone in this room is being less than genuine.
That's not, I mean, put the phone away.
Listen to the laugh. The laugh gives it away.
Here's what you need to know about Keisha. least not an ounce of journalistic integrity in that
it's
man's
not
body.
True. I was on PBS National.
The only thing,
News Hour.
The only thing that Keith Schrummel cares
about
is that people he thinks are powerful, are influential.
Right.
Are rich.
Yeah. Oh, bingo.
Like him. That's all he cares about.
Right.
Keith Strudler does not speak truth to power.
That's journalism, right? That's journalism.
Keith Strudler carries water.
I did, by the way, get David Stern coffee in the morning.
Quite literally, carries water.
I got to take him down in the elevator at the
That's
end.
That's right.
So Keith Strudler was a little upset that some of his students would not just kowtow to the NBA commissioner. And would not ask him questions like, what's it like being so great?
That's basically what the Columbia students
ask. That they would ask real questions. And he goes, I can't believe they did that. Now we won't be best friends.
That's not the wording I used. I was worried that this thing might break bad, right? And so I was worried that I was going to get a call from, let's say, someone involved in the NBA basically telling me I was going to have to go into the witness protection.
You thought that David Stern was going to disappear you.
I was very nervous.
David Stern, and
I have a little bit of a family relationship with the former commissioner, and I was worried it was going to get back maybe to my mom. So I was just I will say I've admitted. Look, I take full credit for this because I'm the one who's teaching students. I'm the one who sits there in classes and teaches them how to kind of analyze the influence of the corporate infrastructure on the sports landscape. I'm the one who's taught them to be critical of these media messages that we're told about, that come from this highly capitalistic space. I'm the ones who teach them that, to be truly critical consumers of the media that they purvey and for which they will be a working member of someday because we have such a great program. So, yes, I deserve all that credit. Now...
And you also teach your students when they're in front of those people that run, the people that are the media elites and the elites in the sports world, that you need to forget all of that and be nice to them so they'll take you to lunch.
So I was,
they're going to Cipriani.
I was worried because I already was making the tables for the Hannah Storm Lifetime Excellence, and I figured Stern might sit at my table. And if he's going to be angry at me, that's going to make it really uncomfortable. I've already got a table together.
You're a diva. Did you plan your own wedding, or?
No. I tried, but you don't get a lot of air in there. So my thought is this is what I'm thinking for my table. Stern?
We'll back up a second. Maris, last year, for the first time, gave a Lifetime Excellence in Sports Communication Award to Bryant Gumbel.
That's right.
They're giving another one in a few months to Hannah Storm.
Exactly. And it's going to be April 20th. Mark and I, and the sponsorship's available. We'll be peddling that pretty soon. We raised a lot of money to support the center and all these students here and to do all these great trips that we're doing.
Marist College students are very happy that the event is on April 20th. Do you care to share why?
That was Pete.
Pete's happy that it's April 20th?
April 20th. This is April
20th. It might relate to our first segment.
Is a day in which the use of marijuana is celebrated amongst many people in America.
Is that true?
Have you ever heard of 420?
It is true.
Oh, God. Did I just do that?
I'm not as celebrant of this holiday.
All right.
Merely an observer. We don't celebrate it.
I know we need to go to a break soon, but here's what I'm thinking. So on April 20th, we're getting the second Lifetime Excellence Award in Sports Communication to Hannah Storm, and I started to put tables together, as I like to do, and I think this is what I think for my table. I want it to be David Stern, my good friend Matthew Hiltzik, and his dad, George Hiltzik, all close with David Stern, myself, maybe John Frankel. Maybe John Frankel, maybe Jack Ford, and I'm hoping we might be able to somehow convince the current commissioner, Adam Silver, we squeeze all that into a table. That's a good table.
It's all the time we've got for that segment.
What can we call that segment?
Coming up in the second hour of the Clash, Keith Strudler's Ego Lies. Coming up in the second hour of the Clash, we're going to talk about some of the new sports that you may be watching in the Olympics, and these are sports that you probably don't expect to be part of the Olympiad. Stay tuned. Olympic discussion is next in the classroom as we go to our second hour after this on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. We go to the second hour of the classroom, and for the first time, a full hour of the classroom. That's for the first time here today. We had a little technical difficulties in the early going of this program, but we worked it out. And now here we are getting ready for our second
hour.
But
I'm still
angry
about
it.
I'm still angry about it.
It happened, and now it's time to move on.
But I'm angry about it, and you know why I'm angry about it? Because we're not on the live stream. Now, but you can stream the show, the audio version of the show, And if you go to the Center for Sports Communication, or if you go to the the Classroom's Twitter feed, either one, it's ESPN underscore Classroom or SportsCom Marist on the Twitter feed, they have the link to the live audio stream of the show, which is live and kicking. So you can listen to the show, but you can't watch the show. And I understand it's almost as good, but it's not quite as good. And what's even worse is we had a photographer here this morning to take some pictures, and so he took pictures of us doing a fire drill. And that's not cool. He took pictures of us running down the stairs like the building was on fire.
Do you know what I thought of? Because it was odd that we had a photographer here taking publicity photos today when things are going awry. I felt for the first time, like, you know how like celebrities and people get their picture taken when they don't want their picture being taken?
Yeah, right?
For the first time, I'm like, I wanted to tell this guy, and it's not his fault. It's not at all his fault. He's doing his job. He's trying to get better. He's taking pictures of us not doing our program, but trying to fix scramble and fix things.
When he was standing over me trying to retype in the
5110001,
and I was like, I want to tell this guy to back off. I'm like, why is this guy doing this? This is the most annoying thing ever.
Well, I don't
know. So, you know what? Celebrities, I'm officially on your side.
Oh, yeah. You know what it's like.
To be fair, I was on their side before, but now I can empathize and not just sympathize.
But so I am still a little salty about the fact that we weren't able to make the stream work because we put a lot of time into setting this whole thing up on Friday. You wouldn't know about that, but we're here working.
Maybe if I was here, it would have worked.
No, I highly doubt that because you were completely supportive.
Everybody who got us on air at the Iron Bowl in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, raise your hand.
Oh, no.
Oh, I see my hand is up.
I got us on the air in
Excuse
Tuscaloosa.
Me.
Put your hands
and
down. Well, that's
put
true.
Your hand
yeah, Adam and Michael, that's true. They helped.
What did you just call him?
Well, Michael?
No.
Anna?
That's
yeah.
I was
Matt.
Just trying to draw
Matt.
On Matt.
I've never met Matt before.
Matt's
this
one.
Is Matt's first time in the classroom.
It's not true. That's absolutely.
He helped with Tuscaloosa.
Matt has been here like every week.
No. Matt's new.
Oliver is probably still up in the studio setting up.
So this is a real problem that we weren't able to get the live stream working. I'm going to have to deal with that. And again, I've had another glorious week here at work at the Center for SportsCom making national news with David Stern, and I'm still dealing this is a recurring problem for me is that I am highly successful yet I'm still treated very poorly. Is that fair? I mean, I am.
No, it's not fair.
No, it's not. I need examples.
I am 100% fair. I am doing God's work here, and I am not given the support and respect that I think I rightfully deserve. And that's it's a huge point of contention, and it's something I think we're all going to have to rectify at some point. And I was in such a good mood this morning, and now I got to go home, and I've got to go do my Giving Tree stuff today too.
Ooh.
I gotta
do nothing.
That.
Nothing really dampens a mood like some charity work. Let me tell you.
For me,
you're like, oh, and you don't understand. After the show, I have to help people in need.
But the worst part
after
is,
saying he does God's work.
God.
Do you realize how that sounds?
God has people.
Like, listen, I was in such a good mood, and then my donuts flipped, and we had some technical difficulties in this radio show, and then later, guys, seriously, later. I have to do charity.
But the worst part is my version of charity is just going out and buying things.
Well, I actually believe that it's probably not the best thing to say during the Christmas season. I actually believe the best thing that people can do for a lot of these causes is support them monetarily.
I know you've thought that a long time.
Like people are like, well, you don't. But I went and took 4 weeks of my time and flew to a war-torn nation to
help rebuild
a village. I'm like, yeah, you know what? Those people probably need more than your inexperienced hands building them a shelter.
No.
They could probably use a check.
You're saying that. You're saying that only because you are relatively, if not exclusively, selfish with your time.
With my time?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. But I am generous with my money, especially this time of year.
But you are very, very selfish with your time.
Yes,
like,
correct.
You don't like to do – the only time I see you volunteer to do things when I say something like, oh, do you want to go to the Final Four?
I would volunteer to do that.
So then you're like, oh, I'll make time for that.
I will.
You literally – I'll take – let me schedule – let's go to the Iron Bowl. Oh,
yeah. I'm in. I can make that work. Yeah.
It's only when there are things that are beneficial to you. But if I'm like, hey, you know what? There's a high school. They need us to come down and help clean the field.
Nope.
You're absolutely too busy.
Not what I do, but you know what I would do?
You'd write it.
I would donate to their fund for a new field. I believe in the power of high school athletics.
Sure. But you would never go out and
do it myself?
No.
Heck no.
But that's the problem.
How is that a problem?
Because they say that the reason that struggling countries don't succeed is because people only donate things and don't help fix the actual problem.
That's a different issue.
Right, that's a problem.
I'm not saying that's an infrastructure issue.
All the places people give money to are necessarily the best places.
That's an infrastructure.
Right.
But here's what I'm going to disagree with you, and once again remind the viewers that you are actually Scrooge. Because this is the reality. Like things like Habitat for Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
This is why, because everyone has a little skin in the game. Right, so my Habitat for Humanity story is that once I actually did some charity work. So I went out, and in all fairness, I had to, because it was my dad's company that was doing that.
His father, of course, a big construction guy in Texas, yeah.
So I went out, and we were building a house.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out there, and I was painting.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so I'm painting a house, and I maybe got through like 3 panels. I'm not the best painter. I'm not the most efficient.
You're an amateur painter.
So I'm out painting this house. And it's like 5 o'clock, and I'm like, all right, time to call it a day. We'll come back here tomorrow. And they bring out the big time construction crew guys with the giant, the paint throwers,
uh-huh.
And they paint that whole house in like 12 minutes.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, why did you make me come out here and paint this house when you guys were going to do the whole rest of the house in like a 50 at the time? And they're like, because this way. Everyone feels like they're part of the solution.
Yeah, but that's doing charity so you feel good, not to do charity.
But
I think Habitat for Humanity is an excellent organization.
Right.
Excellent. I think the work that they do is vital. Love it. Great charity. Here's what I don't want.
What?
I don't want to build a house. Here's why I don't want to build a house.
Then you don't think
Here's
it's
the
a
thing.
Good, then you
no,
don't think it's
listen,
a good cause.
I am an awful builder of things.
But they're going to teach.
And here's
you.
The other thing.
Okay.
I don't want. Look, Habitat for Humanity is very popular amongst college students. There's a big chapter here at Marist College.
Right.
I don't want these children building my house.
I will tell you, I agree with
that
you.
That is not a house that anyone should live in.
I will tell you.
Better than no house.
But what
home.
I do support.
No, I agree with
what
you.
I do support is giving money to an organization like Habitat for Humanity that can then use that money to hire experienced people, talented people, to build houses for people in need.
I don't want to live in a house built
by Keith Strudler.
That's not how you build a community. You don't build a community by simply throwing your money at people. You build a community by getting to know them and being involved and helping out. Everyone helps out. We work together.
I'd be happy to get to know them.
No, you wouldn't.
After they're living in their well-built house.
You wouldn't. You wouldn't. You need to go and be a part of that community. Michael Hines, it looks like you're wanting ready to say something. Have you been involved in the Habitat for Humanity?
I have not been involved.
All right,
Habitat.
Enough then. Never mind.
I can't put in my 2 cents then.
I'll allow it.
Go ahead.
I'll allow it.
I'm just saying, doesn't it seem like a good idea to have a house built by students from a non-engineering college? It should be sturdy.
Yeah.
That was sarcasm. I respect that. I respect that. He's like our Nathan Fielder over there, where he says things that you think are serious, then you have to think about it for a second. You go, I'm pretty sure that's a joke.
I understand. We don't have civil engineering.
I love it.
But they're not asking you to do civil engineering. They're asking you to hold a hammer and a nail, which I believe you can do if life came. I mean, that's it. And by the way, don't think that the pros do a good job.
I do think the pros do a good job.
You don't, because wait till your house starts falling apart. They slap those things together. Trust me. Your roof is held on by a cotter pin right now. So don't think. Don't believe for a second that your house is somehow going to survive the hurricane. And that thing floats away, right? It floats away, all right? The wind breaks 40 miles an hour, and you'll be seeing the stars. So don't believe that for a second. So that is a reality. So, yes, you should be involved. So, at any rate, yeah, I was complaining. So I was in a good mood. Now I'm in a less good mood. There's a lot of reasons for that. The number one reason is because we had all these technical issues, which you're welcome. I fixed.
Oliver's
and
here.
So I was able to kind of make that go. But beyond that, I probably will have a hard time recovering this day.
Maybe talking about the Olympics will make you happy. I don't know anybody likes the Olympics more than Keith Strudler. Keith Strudler loves him some
and
Olympics.
Weird sports.
I do, weird sporting events. I do love
new
the Olympics. And I do. In fact, we're taking a bunch of students to. To Lausanne, where there's a bunch of different sports headquartered, and we're going to be doing that visit with the students studying in Florence next semester. We'll be going to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which is a giant mansion, and it's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of rich people. That's my scene. So we'll be doing that, and I do. I like the Olympics. I'm increasingly having a hard time dealing with the ethos of the Olympic Games at this point, just because there's so many sordid facts that come out of their operations.
They've gotten quite far away from their stated original value.
And there's been corruption in the Olympic Games.
Were they
ever
close to that?
Oh, yeah, sure, back in, like, the 1800s.
There have been many moments in Olympic history where they've gone awry, and I don't know that they ever really truly were altruistic in the sense that they stated on their goals. I mean, this was started by a French guy who wanted to use the games to promote colonialism and kind of an ethos of greatness amongst the French aristocracy. So I won't pretend, and basically bought off the Greeks to make sure that they weren't being held over there and allowed them to have the first games in Athens, but it was really a Western European-centric rich guy kind of thing. So I'm not going to pretend, which is very much what it is today, right? It's a bunch of rich Western Europeans who kind of decide which part of the world they want to colonize. So I get all that. But I think this is one of those moments that we've gone through in the last games in Brazil, and certainly looking ahead to going back to China, its place in Russia, where it really seems to have stepped so afar of any kind of normalized value system that you might associate with what the Olympics idealizes themselves to be, that it's hard to take them seriously. And beyond the fact that I'm not so sure that we really need these anymore. The idea that we need the games to decide who the fastest runners in the world are, and it's almost an antiquated idea that gets dealt with through a variety of other international sports championships.
Young people don't buy into the Olympics.
Right.
The Rio ratings among 18 to 49-year-olds was 20% lower than the London Games. Young people just aren't, for whatever reason, they don't seem to embrace the Olympics the way older generations has, and it could be for a number of reasons. The Olympics are now trying to skew younger for their next games, their next summer games anyway. It was announced this week that they have given provisional status to cheerleading. They've given provisional status to Muay Thai, which is basically kickboxing.
Not the drink.
No, Mai Tai is an alcoholic beverage.
Yeah.
Muay Thai is basically a kickboxing.
A martial art.
Mixed martial art.
I'm going to take this time to remind everybody that baseball was also re-added this past summer.
Yep, baseball.
I know that's not on here, but, you know, that's important.
No, it is.
It is.
Oh,
it's on there.
It?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's on there.
Okay. Well, there you go. Sorry.
other quote-unquote younger sports that might be in the Olympics, skateboarding, surfing, something called sport climbing as opposed to regular climbing.
Sport climbing like a rock climbing kind of situation?
I hope it's like the wall in American Gladiators.
Sure.
Where you have a contender from one country who has to chase up the wall, but chasing him to pull him off the wall is a larger contender from a different country.
Mm. And will they have nicknames?
I hope so.
And wear very tight spandex clothing with American flags.
A lot of sequins. It really chance to have some flair for the athletes,
yeah.
Yes.
I look, the Olympics, the Winter Olympics went through this, right, where the Winter Olympics was trying to make themselves younger, right, and mm-hmm. and they added a whole bunch of extreme sports kinds of competitions.
Basically snowboarding.
Yeah, and so that's part of what they did. In many cases, they're not just making themselves younger, they're also making themselves more appealing to American sports tastes and highly capitalistic sports tastes. I think cheerleading, just like snowboarding and some of those other sports, will be events that Americans will do very well at and that we'll watch. Right? And so it won't be a secret where the gold medal is going to go for cheerleading. I have to believe we come in as a strong favorite for cheerleading if it does actually become an Olympic sport.
I'm just thinking about this right now. I don't have the slightest idea. Are there cheerleaders, like competitive cheerleaders,
yes,
in
I can
other
talk
countries?
About it if you want.
I don't know that there is and I don't know.
Why is Oliver gesticulating wildly about international cheerleading?
If you want to, get on, but do you know about international cheerleading competitions? Oliver seems to be an expert in
I think we found his niche.
So, okay. Oliver, could you speak to international cheerleading competitions?
International cheerleading competitions. A lot of them happen in the U.S., but have teams from other countries coming to the U.S. as a center or a hub. I had my sister actually did competitive cheerleading and it's closer to gymnastics.
Right.
And a lot like dance choreography, gymnastics, a lot of throwing of people, and then some of the more traditional centralized thing that you would expect to see out of cheerleaders like on the sideline of a game.
but it really is a intense competition. There are teams that come from all over the world.
So it's not just standing like, that's all right, that's okay.
No, no, no. Competitive cheerleading is without a doubt a sport.
It's got to be. I mean, it's like gymnastics.
And they do, they do. I've watched the competitions down at Disney quite a bit, and that seems to be the hub for where they do these national competitions. They're always high school teams. Why are you laughing?
Well, I've seen the movie Bring It On, so I feel like I'm an expert in this topic as well.
No, it's just like that. It's scarily like
I actually, I actually once was in a hotel for a wedding in Dallas, like a family wedding. It was like one of those 1,800-room hotels, and there we were. My cousin, my wife's cousin, was having a wedding there, and the entire rest of the hotel was booked up with people there for the cheerleading competition. And I do remember specifically getting, it's like a high school, you know, cheerleading contest, getting on an elevator, and we're going up to like the 90th floor, and someone looks at me halfway up there, and she goes, "You're not here for the cheerleading competition."
Scheduling those trips is a nightmare, by the way.
Well, I'm sure.
They hang you out to dry. You're all on your own, and they just expect you to show up to the competition. Transportation, yourself, booking it yourself, and then you just need to be there on time.
Well, it sounds like an economic opportunity.
Well, and I think that if it's in the Olympics, we're going to see a lot more of not just high school cheerleading, but real, like, gymnastic-based. They do a lot of strength training, too. A lot of those females and males are, like, CrossFit-type people.
Sure. Maybe CrossFit. CrossFit would be a great Olympic sport.
Isn't CrossFit...
It's not an Olympic sport.
It's not an Olympic sport.
No, it's not.
To be fair,
it's a Reebok sponsored sport.
It's a sport that Keith Strutler would like because it's just exercise. Keith Strutler's favorite sports are just exercise.
Yeah.
I think they should just do a sport where it's the highest calorie count.
I want to get back to more of Oliver's knowledge of international cheerleading. Right. Obviously, America's the best because America's the best at everything.
Right.
But what are the other nations that have good competitive cheerleading?
I mean, I know from just experience of the teams that my sisters competed against, and just to also give an idea, in the United States, it's really not schools that are competing. It's these gyms, these regional gyms. Like my sister had to drive. My mom drove her like hour and a half there, hour and a half back. And then you get teams from China and Europe or the big, and there were teams from other countries, but those were the biggest ones where you go like, oh, those are the international competing
teams. Which countries in Europe? Like
probably the gymnastics powers, right? Like Romania.
Yeah, I was gonna say Russia. Maybe Russia's in Asia.
Russia's in Europe.
Those
the capitals in Europe. It's in Europe.
Those countries, but then also there's a strange recruiting thing going on, the same way there are in other sports, where you just all of a sudden have these teams that are from Boston, Massachusetts. However, you look at the members of the team, and they have all been recruited from
other
countries.
They don't speak any English, right? Yeah.
Which is fine, and that adds another dimension to it, but it doesn't always take the form of the team from Germany or the team from China. Sometimes it's just a team that is completely comprised or 90% comprised of competitors from that country.
So we're going to dominate this thing, right, if we go to the...
Darn right we are. USA all day.
We're going to dominate this thing. Now, The status they were given is relatively low on it's a low-hanging kind of situation.
Yes.
They get $25,000 a year for their federation. They're, in essence, being recognized. Right. And that's all this is really.
It's a provisional status. Yeah. It's basically saying, here's a little bit of money, build yourself up as best you can, and if you do an exceptionally great job, consider putting you in the
Olympics.
Exactly.
What I am curious about, and I'm not sure really how this might work out, and part of the Olympic problem has been, at least from an administrative perspective, it has gotten way too big. There's too many sports, too many athletes competing, and it's almost unwieldy. And this is part of the problem for cities.
Yeah.
When you have 10,000 athletes competing and, you know, thousands and thousands of administrators and all these different organizing committees that have to run these things in different facilities, it's like creating an entire economy. And I think part of and nations increasingly still want to be a part of it. As it shifted from a political event to a kind of a money-making event, I think the idea that you might sit the games out became kind of a non-starter. So everyone wants to be at the games now, even these very marginal nations. I don't know how adding more sports to the games becomes a good kind of administrative kind of process, right? And so I do wonder to what extent this kind of process, unless they're going to start to pair sports that seem non-relevant, and I know they looked at wrestling and they've looked at some of these other sports to see if maybe the things that were mainstays in the Olympics no longer need to be mainstays of the Olympics. And that's going to be the real devil in the details kind of situation. I mean, yeah, you could just add everything. You could literally add everything. There are some rules about what you can and can't add. They need to be contested by a certain number of countries and need to have it's just like making Division I sports. You have to hit certain criteria. And I understand that they want to attract more eyeballs in doing this, but I don't think you can just add and add and add and make this work out.
I think part of the problem with the Olympics and why its appeal is down is it's too much. It's just too much. I mean, they're trying to fill 2 weeks, 24/7, with competition.
Well, they do.
I know. And it's too much.
It is too much.
Nobody's watching the judo, and nobody's watching the fencing. People want to watch the major track and field events. They want to watch the basketball. They want to watch, you know, the gymnastics. They want to watch what they want to watch.
The swimming.
But they keep adding these other sports. And yet, sure, there's absolutely a niche. There's absolutely certain people. Like, I love water polo. I understand that I'm pretty much, it's just me. Like, I'm the only guy streaming Hungary, Belarus water polo at 10 in the morning on a Thursday. I get that.
Right.
But I didn't know you liked water polo.
So I get what you're saying, right? I totally get what you're saying. But I do think, I think they are contending with the idea that younger sports fans are not interested in a lot of the traditional sporting events. There's a whole generation of people that are turning off the Olympics because they don't care who wins the marathon.
You're saying like the archery, the wrestling, like those
care.
Type of sports?
I agree. I even think to some extent they care less than we might think about who wins the marathon and even who wins the 100-meter dash and stuff. I mean, I understand when Usain Bolt runs, they get good numbers.
I think people care about the 100 meters. The other ones, I agree.
The other ones. They're not the pole vault and the stuff that used to just kind of, you know, keep our eyes relatively glazed to the screen, not as relevant anymore. And I think the Winter Games, as a model, was a pretty successful kind of case study in how to make yourself younger and more relevant. All of a sudden, the Winter Games went from being something that was very much a second, I mean, things that were contested in small cities, Lake Placid, to being a major player. People watch it, and you get thousands of participants and thousands of eyeballs. It's kind of, I mean, when Brian Gumbel, like, literally made fun of it and said, how can you even pretend these are the best athletes in the world, right? Now, there were some social issues that came with that as well. But I think there is a model. The difference is the Winter Games started with nothing. And they were able to expand. I don't know how the Summer Games is going to be able to keep adding and adding and adding eyeballs.
I think there's a coolness factor to the Winter Games, right? There's activities,
pun intended,
that are actually not pun intended, but a good pun.
Good job.
You know, you watch the ski jump, and that's captivating to watch because a guy is launching himself down a mountain off a ramp, flying high up in the air and might kill themselves.
Belly first.
The luge and the skeleton and the bobsled. These are compelling. There's a danger element. Like there's a compelling reason to, if you flip past it, to watch it. If you flip past an Olympic basketball game between Brazil and Chile,
there's no reason to stop and watch that because there's
12 other basketball games.
Absolutely no reason to watch. I mean, I've done that. I've gone through that. I'm like, why would anyone pay attention to a bunch of D-League guys? I mean, this is what we're looking at.
They're worse than that.
Yeah, that's true. So it operates on nationalism, only on nationalism, right? We get that. Mm-hmm. Maybe cheerleading adds a coolness factor. Let's start with it. I will say right now, they put cheerleading in the Olympics, I'm watching it the first year. There's no question. No question I'm watching it the first year.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, you talk about how some people don't care about things like archery or some of those sports or events that are a little bit just more focused on how broad is the appeal of hitting a target with an arrow from a distance. But I think cheerleading might be one that brings in a wider appeal because it has an importance on things like the music and costumes and the cool. attitude. Right. There's part of the scoring involved is the smiling and the jovial nature of the competitors. Like if you are there
an attitude score.
And you do.
It's proven. People like to watch people fly around and do flips be weird with their bodies. Like those sports sell.
And it has more appeal. Basically, what I'm just saying is that it's got more to it than just the act of cheerleading. Which if you don't know,
it's a real sport.
We're not arguing.
No, not at all.
It's a real sport. But I'm just saying if you were to show somebody archery and they're like, well, if I'm not so much into archery, what else is there to watch?
There's no appeal. Now I will say. I do watch that winter biathlon where they got to ski and shoot.
We did. Because, again, just like the luge and the bobsled and the skeleton, it's compelling.
It's so
like, wait a minute, that guy's cross-country skiing with a gun on his back. I'd like to see where this goes.
Now, by the way,
this could go badly.
If they made that competitive with one another, you got a whole other game going on.
But they're shooting at each other, not
the target? I'm suggesting rubber bullets, whatever you want to do.
Paintballs, perhaps.
There are ways to make this work. But, that becomes a lot more interesting. When we were at the Olympic
Frozen
Museum.
Paintballs, though.
Yeah. We're at the Olympic Museum. We were able to kind of simulate that, where you were able to kind of, like, run as fast as you can, and then you picked up a gun, and you had to shoot it at the target. I was really good at the running part. I was less good at hitting the targets. But I understand why the Olympics is looking for ways to make themselves, kind of get younger. And you do have to evolve, right? Sporting events do have to evolve. The challenge for the Olympics is, A, they're too big as it is. B, they've got all these geopolitical things that are working against them and economic realities that are going to be working against them from and media realities are going to be working against them from now until infinity. So that's going to be an issue. And I do think when you're the Olympics and you have to hold on to a certain prestige. I mean, there's a reason why the Olympic sponsorship is the most expensive sponsorship in all of sports, and it's because it has an enormous value and appeal, this non-commercialized, historic, kind of elite, very idealistic appeal. I think one of the only risks for something like the Olympics when they start to look at these edgier sports is they simply start to become the X Games. So cheerleading, no offense to cheerleading or any of these, they don't remind me of Athens or Olympia, right? They don't harken back to kind of the storied nature of the Olympic Games. So I think they risk, while they might, potentially get some appeal with eyeballs, they also risk their brand. And once their brand, when they're competing against the X Games, they're no longer in a good place.
The Olympics stops being the Olympics and just becomes a major international multi-sport competition.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not a competitive space for them. And so they might even still win that, but it's not a guarantee. This is like what networks go after when all of a sudden ESPN is just simply competing against some guy's blog and is because everyone could be on the internet, ESPN gets watered down. And so I think there is a huge risk for the Olympics in becoming in watering down their brand. Now, I also think that's probably why they do this very slowly. Nothing gets in the Olympics overnight, and it will take quite some time. I would also suggest that if the Olympics were to bring cheerleading, that would be a great time to have the Olympics in the United States. So, there's strategy to all of these decisions.
2024 could be L.A. I think L.A. is one of the top three cities, right? L.A.,
yeah,
Paris,
really
and
good.
Is it Budapest?
Something
can't
like
remember
that.
I'm not sure I can remember the third one.
So if you remember in Sydney, that's when they brought triathlon into the games. And there was a reason for that. Triathlon happens to be one of those popular sports in Australia. And it was the first event. They had the harbor. And so it wasn't simply adding triathlon because it was a popular sport. It was adding it as a kind of strategic signature event for the Sydney Games and a great TV moment. Imagine if you're out in L.A., which is, I imagine, to be a cheerleading hub, just like Orlando on the East Coast, probably L.A. on the West Coast.
Absolutely.
Imagine if you are able to kind of, the other Disney spot, if you're able to bring cheerleading in as a spectacle of those games, that could be pretty cool.
So where's the strategic hub for snooker?
Yeah, what is snooker?
It's billiards, right? It's like a pool game.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's probably Las Vegas.
That's probably exactly right. Here, by the way, a list put together by our wonderful producing staff of Marist College Center for Sports and Culture.
We do.
Very quickly, a list of sports that have been recognized by the IOC but never quite made it into the Olympics. Air sports. You might be asking, what are air sports? Like hot air ballooning.
Oh, that could, well, you know why I like hot air ballooning? High risk reward kind of situation. Right?
Hang gliding, parachute.
So that's that one I like.
Airplane racing. What?
Bocce.
Bocce. I like bocce.
Bridge. The card game.
Yeah.
Bridge.
Well, yes. Now have they not done card games before?
I don't believe so.
Now,
bridge,
that is kind of a game of chance, though, right?
I don't know. I've never played.
My grandmother plays twice a week.
Competitive ballroom dancing.
Right. No. Ballroom dancing has been in before.
Has it?
Yes.
I don't know
it
that
it has
either.
Been
has
in it? Before. Okay. It has definitely been in before.
Interesting. Good job, Michael Hines.
Is that it?
If you would like, the article where I found all these sports, they also talk about who was the quote-unquote Babe Ruth of that sport.
Yeah.
Who would be most likely to take the medal, and if there's been a movie made about that.
So what I don't want to do is that on the air. So so what I'd like, that could be posted on the Facebook page. I know that. I might as well just said,
okay, but
all right,
life-saving.
You guys just come back and we'll cure cancer. Like people looked at me like I just asked them to do something impossible.
One of my favorite niche sports, hi-a-lie.
Oh, that's a great sport.
Yeah.
Good one.
Big gambling sport. Obviously down in Florida, it's very popular.
Very popular in Brazil and South America as well.
It's very bad for the arm.
I believe that.
Throws the arm out
sure.
of the
sock. Sure, you're whipping that thing 100 miles an hour.
Don't they play it in that, like, Basque region between France and Spain? And they
quite possible.
It's with the big curvy hoop, right?
Yeah,
that's
the big curvy
it's
hoop.
It's crazy. They go so fast.
Right. So that's
it's like a racquetball, but without a racket. You use, like, a banana curvy
but
hoop.
It's really a gambling sport. I mean, it's like greyhound racing.
Do you see life-saving on here? I should compete
for life-saving. Which is swimming under obstacles, recovering a submerged dummy, and pulling a teammate with a rope. The events can take place either in a pool or the ocean.
Well, that is actually so. Lifeguard competitions are very popular, and I watch those a lot. It's like a Baywatch kind of situation.
So there you go.
All right, let's go to break.
We will take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how conference championships don't matter anymore in college football and whether we're okay with that or not. Stay tuned. More of the Classroom ahead. Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. More of your weekly Smart Look at Sports here from the Marist College Center for Sports Communication. My name is Jeff Brault alongside Dr. Keith Strudler, Michael Hines, Anna Grizzoulis, a bunch of interns here at Marist helping us produce this program. Again, we apologize for all our technical difficulties this morning. It's been a tough day. But a tough day for all of us.
It is now. Now I'm kind of down because I was in a good mood, and now I'm not in as good a mood. And that's a bummer because I was in a really good mood. I mean, I've had a great week. I basically pushed the national envelope with David Stern, and I codified that relationship really strongly, and I was able to really kind of lead our students into some true journalistic inquiry. And just go ahead and Google that. Look up Marist and David Stern. You'll see kind of work I'm doing here. And then go ahead while you're at it and go check out the commentary I did for PBS NewsHour last week. I'm sure the first of many. And that's, of course, in my humble opinion, aptly titled. And then while you're at it, if someone could go out there and help me and just pick up my Giving Tree items, that would be really helpful. Then I could just sit.
What did you pick off the Giving Tree?
Well, I don't want to talk about that. That seems a little much. But let's just say I went for things that one year we had a real problem, if you remember correctly.
This is when we sent Marist interns while on air to buy your Giving Tree.
I went and picked something that I really wasn't exactly sure what it was, if you remember that. I believe
it was like young girls' pants.
It was a pants thing, but I wasn't, and I just couldn't figure it out. And I went to a bunch of stores, and I couldn't figure it out. By the way, Giving Tree, Giving Tree is one of the wonderful things that Marist does.
Correct.
They help to provide holiday gifts for families that that are in need, and I think that's a great thing. We kind of make fun of it. It's a great one of the many great charitable works that Marist is involved with. And we complain about our employer all the time, but certainly not about their involvement in the community. So great thing. But I've had a great week until this morning. When I came in here, and I once again for the second week in the row, I had a bit of an episode. I had a little bit of a surly, not pleasant. Like you're seeing the side of me that my kids know.
You were much better than last week.
Sure. Well, last week I just completely lost it.
It was a meltdown.
Last week was me because last week I was really riding high on national TV, and the crash is always the higher you are, the harder the fall. And so that created a big problem for me.
So what'd you pick off the Giving Tree this year?
Well, that seems very personal. There are things that I can easily get. Clothing,
okay.
Stuff like that.
Sure.
Stuff that I can give them all.
Great. What's wrong with that?
That's good.
Yeah, I agree.
That's great.
It's a great thing to participate in.
That's great. I'm very happy about it.
Okay.
All right, we're good.
All right, good.
I'm just, look, here's my problem. My problem is I'm a little lazy. I don't know if that's
a little.
An issue, recurring issue. The number of times my wife has said to me, as she's like doing laundry and like dishes, she'll say something like, "Are you just going to sit there?" And the only answer,
yes,
because it's. I always assumed it might just be a rhetorical question, and I should leave it as such. But when I give an answer, I mean, the only correct answer to that is, "How can I help?" But that's not actually the right. It's a yes or no question.
Your wife doesn't want you to do the dishes. She
right.
wants you to want to do the dishes.
That's right. Because everyone knows when I do the dishes, I'm just going to hold them and let the dog lick them and then put them into the shelf. So we don't want that. No one wants that. Are we going to talk about college football games?
Sure, why not? So the college football playoff was announced. Alabama, Clemson, and Ohio State, Washington.
The way you're leading into this is already, you set the tone for
no,
the segment.
It was okay. A fine segment. It's right. I think it's a little simplistic for what we do, but it's fine.
Oh, yeah, we've never done simple before.
It's fine.
All right.
It's a fine segment.
It's a little sporty, I know.
Which you hate.
I knew none.
Which you hate.
I hate doing things about sports.
Basically, what we've learned is that the college football playoff does not care about conferences. They don't care about conference champions. They just don't. They are going to pick what they believe are the four best college football teams, regardless of trophies and titles won during the season.
That's
Penn
right.
State's Big Ten champion. Penn State's not in the college football playoff. Ohio State is. Penn State beat Ohio State. So these head-to-head matchups, the committee looks at the body of work as a whole, independent of conference championships. I think it's fine. It doesn't really bother me one bit. I think a conference championship is wholly separate from whether you make the playoff. Penn State got their Big Ten championship trophy. They are the Big Ten champions. Kudos to them. Ohio State's overall body
of
work.
You said that condescendingly.
Ohio State's body of work over the course of the season, including their loss to Penn State, better than Penn State. Ohio State should be in the playoff.
Well, if you believe in what, I guess, the playoff presented itself as being, which is the four best teams in college football, although there isn't really a metric on what they actually are, because they say they consider all these different things. The issue seems to be that a couple of years ago, they penalized a team, it seemed, for not being a conference champion, right? TCU dropped from second to sixth, I believe, because they were a conference co-champion, but they didn't have a championship game to play in.
Yeah.
So they dropped all the way down.
Yeah, and when I say the college football playoff has shown itself to be, that means this year.
Yeah.
I mean, this benchmark is constantly changing and will be different every year to suit the whims of the committee. We see it in the NCAA tournament all the time. I think last year, Monmouth was the perfect example. They tell schools like Monmouth, if you want to get in as an at-large, if you stumble in your conference tournament, here's what you have to do. You got to go on the road.
Yep.
You got to play elite teams on the road. You got to win those games. Monmouth went out, did that. You got to play in an elite neutral site tournament. You got to win some games there, raise your national profile, get victories on television in big-time games. Monmouth goes out and does that. You have to be excellent in your conference. Monmouth went out, was excellent in their conference. They stumbled in their conference tournament, lost the MAC championship.
To Iona, I believe. Right?
Exactly.
A good Iona team.
A very good Iona team. And were left out
right.
of the bracket. Now, there's a number of reasons why Monmouth was left out. But Monmouth went out and fulfilled all of the criteria that in the past selection committees have said schools like Monmouth need to adhere to if they want to have a shot at getting in an at-large bid. They do that, and then the committee that year goes, well, this year, it's not what we were looking for, so you're out. So, yeah, it's a moving target. It's always going to be a moving target, and as long as you use selection committees and not a computer process like the BCS, that's what you have to accept.
Which, as you know, I'm all for computers doing everything.
I am as well.
Let's automate the whole world. But I think the question, look, whether or not they're picking the four best teams, that's going to be an issue that's left to the people on that committee and the people that created the college football playoff in the first place. Mm-hmm. And they'll probably adapt that based on kind of the general acceptance of this as policy. And whether they expand to eight teams, which it seems Mark Emmert has already now said, oh, I like that idea.
Oh, yeah.
Even though the college presidents largely have kind of been a little lukewarm to that suggestion.
Sure, because it's going to cost them money.
Yeah,
they're going to lose money if that happens.
It's an issue. I mean, it'll create other kind of it's a butterfly effect when you go to eight teams. But the thing that I wonder is what is this going to mean for conference championships? Because I do think that what happened to Penn State will have some effect not only on the reason they created these conference championship games is because it generates millions and millions of dollars in television revenue.
Well, Ken, they have to be good games.
Yeah, but I'm saying the contracts. The contracts
are huge. Yeah.
The conferences are getting big money. Whether people are watching that's another issue. But they are getting huge checks. The SEC created that model, and everyone realized, like, oh, you can make a lot of money by adding that 13th game.
Penn State, by the way, in the now 3-year history of the college football playoff, is the first conference champion left out. Ohio State's the first non-conference champion in.
So we have a model by which this might actually happen. And, I mean, you had conference co-champions that didn't get in. There's been five Power Five. That's not true. You're talking about maybe the first that won a conference championship game that didn't get in. Is that a better way to put it?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but they were conference champions.
Right. Like, right. Yeah, the Big 12 didn't have one for a while. Yeah.
So, we understand that as just a kind of a reality, right? That you might have a team left out, but I don't know that they can sustain the model that they have with conference championship games. I think they will become increasingly devalued and less. So I think this thing that the college football playoffs did by leaving one of those teams out will force one of two things to happen. One is they're either going to expand to 8 games and, you know, say all conference champions are in, and, mm-hmm. and we'll deal with it without five in. We get 3 at large. One has to be small conference. Yeah. Bingo. Done.
That's exactly how it should be. That would be amazing this year. You'd have Western Michigan in and another undefeated team.
Yeah, right. It's all done. Right. We understand. But that progress happens very slowly. I mean, look how long it took us to get to here. So we understand that, right? But I think the other thing, though, that could happen is, one is television networks could start to say, I don't know that it's worth spending this much money for this game if it's going to be something that really doesn't have the inherent value that we want, that people are kind of looking at it as a meaningless title. And we've seen this happen in other sports where things that used to matter don't matter as much. So that's possible. The other thing that this could push is, if you are really going to say there are only X number of spots in the playoffs, even whether now or in a future model with an expanded playoff, and we want to ensure that conference champions are in it, I think this is another push towards the consolidation of conferences into a four conference super deal, right? Where you now expand this to 16 teams, and in a model with fewer conferences, I think you're more likely to see those conference champions make it in, particularly if you push the narrative of expanding this to maybe 6 teams. And I think everyone's assumed 8. Don't ignore the likelihood that this is an incremental process. I actually think it's far more likely that we go to 6 teams than we go to 8 teams. And I think you'll see 2 teams getting a bye, and they'll work it that way. I think that's a much more likely scenario. But I do wonder about the shockwaves of the College Football Playoff Committee has sent, I think, to the college football landscape. And I think the playoff has outsized importance, right? It used to be that conferences were the most important thing. This playoff, very quickly, and I think we all expected that. I don't think the BCS ever had the power that the college football playoff had. The BCS was this kind of almost random thing. You never really know who's going to get in. It almost, I don't say it didn't matter, but it was so out of everyone's control.
Well, it wasn't entertaining.
Yeah.
There's nothing entertaining about, and here's the rankings.
And winning a conference title didn't guarantee anything anyway. I think this playoff has enormous power. I think they've built something. The ratings suggested, although take away the New Year's Eve stuff from last year.
Same this year.
But I know. It's not good. But the championships are, you know, and they're big. And the year before certainly was big. And they've changed it already. So it won't be like that in the future. I think this is... the 1,000-pound gorilla. I think the playoff is going to set the table for the rest of the college football landscape in Division I. And I think that committee is going to have to think. I don't know that they considered the importance that they had when they started this thing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think it's best to sum up the committee's job this way. You know, as much as it's their job to pick the 4 best teams in college football, it's also their job to put together the 2 best and most entertaining semifinal matchups.
Do you think so?
Yes.
But why?
Yes.
Why?
Because...
Why is that their job? It's not the NFL's job to pick the 2 most...
Well, because the NFL has a true playoff structure where you play your way in, and there's no committee about it.
Then
if you remove the committee altogether, I'm all for that. You go to 8, you remove the committee, you say you're 5 conference championships, and then we're going to take the next 3 on this criteria, and there's no sit-down and discussion,
I have to disagree. I have to disagree. Why would you... Boy, this sounded like a sports show all of a sudden. But why? I mean, this...
They're in charge, because you just say it's got a chance to be the most valuable and influential product in college football.
It does.
In charge of the most valuable and influential product in college football. They have to make sure they're putting together the best product they can put forward.
But by doing that, they're dismantling a system that exists underneath it.
Correct.
It's going to have massive repercussions. And by the way, as much money as they make off of this playoff, that's not more than all of these colleges make throughout the course of a 13-game schedule.
I mean, the fact of the matter is this. Ohio State lost to Penn State, and that does not make Penn State better than Ohio State.
No, but I think by any objective standard, we always say, and this is how the NFL works, this is how kind of the American psyche works, you decided on the field.
And I'm perfectly fine with that if that's what's in place. That's not what's in place.
I understand, but I think otherwise, there's going to be a feeling of why bother playing in the first place.
I completely understand. I 100% get that sentiment. I do. I get it. But look, the best team doesn't always win. If the best team always won, you wouldn't have to play the game. It could be decided on paper. Upsets are great. Upsets are entertaining.
And that's part of – and that upset should have value.
Right. If the process you have in place – is that it's not decided on the field, because the college football playoff is not decided on the field. Who gets in is not decided
right.
on the field.
It's not in a boardroom.
If it's going to be decided in the boardroom, you have to be okay with the committee looking at Penn State over Ohio State and taking Ohio State.
That's fine. I would love to know what the conference commissioners and the college presidents at the 100, nah, forget the 100, the 50 or 60 college football programs that matter, down deep, think about what that might mean 5 years down the road for their product. Because that's great for the college football playoff product, not good for the product that they have to put out every week.
Alabama's not the only undefeated team in the nation. Western Michigan didn't lose either. But nobody's clamoring for them to be in because they play in the MAC.
I understand. But I want to know what the people at Penn State, the people who negotiate TV contracts and affinity contracts for Penn State, have to say 5 years from now when they say, we did what we're supposed to do and we can't get there. I think that's a dangerous place for college sports to go. It's not the landscape of college basketball.
I agree. And then you need to change. You need to change how teams are selected for the playoff.
We got to take a break.
It needs to be decided on the field then.
We got to take a quick break. Like right now.
I know time it is. I have a clock.
Like right now.
Our grades of the week are...
Just take us to break.
They're weak.
Just take it.
Listen.
Can I do it?
I hope you come back for our next segment. If you don't... listen, we all understand. We'll see you in a second. Fox 20, 97.3 ESPN Radio. Welcome back in the classroom. It's time for our final segment. It used to be a much more robust final segment. Then Keith Strudler stopped doing commentary.
I'll do it next week.
So yeah, no, you won't.
Well, you won't be here and you won't know, so I'm going to tell
you. Oh, I'll listen.
You listen.
I'll listen, and
listen
I won't hear a commentary.
You won't hear one.
You won't hear
one.
You'll hear the entire program, the clanking of the keys of you writing it while
you
on the air. And you won't have me to carry your sorry behind.
The commentary is going to be why this show is better when Jeff's out on the road.
Here are your grades of the week. Or not.
I think it takes a second.
It doesn't.
No,
it doesn't.
No,
it okay, fine.
These
we'll
computers
just,
work.
So there's
fine.
No music
Man.
There. If we had more time, we'd make Anna sing it, but
I'm
we're not
sorry,
going to.
Sorry, guys.
Don't
okay.
worry about it.
Friend of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication, Bobby Valentine. Bobby Valentine, of course, the inventor of the wrap sandwich.
Yep.
Former manager, the New York Mets, among others.
Yeah.
Now currently the athletic director at Sacred Heart University.
Right.
One state away in Connecticut.
And I shared a stage for an hour and a half.
Indeed. He, Keith Strudler, I don't know if you know this, is being considered for a role in the Trump presidency.
Oh, God.
Bobby Valentine is on the short list for ambassador to Japan. Now, Bobby Valentine is beloved in Japan and for a long time managed in the Japanese Baseball League. Keith Strudler, grade a potential Bobby Valentine appointment as ambassador to Japan.
This is a tough one for me. This is an actually great grade because you know I have a particular problem with the way some of these appointments are going in the current presidential campaign. They're not serious. And some might suggest putting Bobby Valentine in an official ambassador's role would be of that ilk. On the other hand, I do like Bobby Valentine. And look, let's be honest. So I'm going to have to – if I'm – there's two arguments I could make. One is this is not serious. This is an embarrassment to America, and we can do better. So I would give it an F. But my overriding ethos and everything that happens is I love to know famous people. Bobby Valentine, as an ambassador to America, opens up potentially. Like, his first phone call is as when he gets his appointment is coming from me. I give it an A. Great, great appointment. Make Japan great again.
Stay tuned. 3 years from today, we'll be doing the classroom live from Tokyo. We're outside the Tokyo Dome for the Japan series. Ambassador Bobby Valentine will be joining us.
I'm sure we'll have Secretary of State Pee Wee Herman joining us as well.
Speaking of people that joined us, all of you out there in Radio Land, we thank you for sticking with us through some technical difficulties this morning and hanging out in the classroom for your weekly Smart Look at Sports. On behalf of all the interns here at Marist College and Dr. Keith Strudler, who runs the Marist College Center for Sports Communication, plus our guest, Josh Greer, who made his classroom debut this morning. My name's Jeff Brault. I'm off next week. These other folks will
Where
be with you.
Where are you going?
Hanover, New Hampshire. I'll be in the Ivy Leagues.
Yep.
Dartmouth.
So pretty there.
Yeah, if you want to know anything about Ivy League schools, just ask me.
10 a.m. to noon next week. The classroom is live. I won't be a part of it, but you can still enjoy it, and we encourage you to.
Yep.
Right here on Fox 12, 20, 97.3 ESPN Radio. That's all we got, folks. Class is dismissed.